Welcome back, my friends, to the D-Rate the Hate podcast. I am your host, Wilk of WilksWorld.com, and I am so incredibly grateful that you are taking the time to join me for another powerful DTH episode. Friends, at the D-Rate the Hate podcast, it's all about bettering the world one attitude at a time. See, we did not create the hate, but with your help, we can derate the hate. That all starts with gratitude and personal accountability. We cannot control everything that happens to us in life, but we can control how we react to it. No matter what happens to us, how we react to it makes the difference. Friends, there is only one good thing about a bad attitude, and that is that we have the ability as individuals to change it. Here on the DTH podcast, we strive to bring you great guests and provide tools to do just that. Please be sure to share it with your friends. Subscribe if you haven't done so. Ratings and feedback are always greatly appreciated. And with that, let's get to this week's episode. Hey, friends, it's a new year, and here is another new episode of the D-Rate the Hate podcast. Now, I've got one more here in the can with my great friend Julian Adorney guest hosting, and another one that you definitely do not want to miss. He is joined by returning guest Daniel Stone, somebody who's been on the show before. You may remember him from episode 161 when I had Dan on to talk about Are Our Political Rivals as Bad as We Think They Are? And his book, Undue Hate. Now, Dan joins Julian this week to talk about just a novel idea that him and another friend of mine, Zach Elwood, had discussed in a recent article. Is it time for a depolarization Manhattan Project? It's really a pretty phenomenal idea, being that, as my friend John Wood Jr. says, and I quote quite often, polarization is the one problem that ensures all other problems will not be solved. So listen in as my friends Julian Adorney and Dan Stone talk about, among other things, is it time for a depolarization Manhattan Project? Now I'll be back in a seat next week, starting with some fresh new interviews. But until then, stay tuned for this incredible conversation with Julian and Dan Stone. Here we go.
Hey, everyone. This is Julian Adorney, guest host filling in for my good friend and colleague, Will Wilkinson. Today, I'm really thrilled to have Daniel Stone on. He is a behavioral economist who talks a lot about affective polarization. He's been on the show before as a friend of the show. And he just wrote a really fascinating op-ed about toxic polarization, how it presents a historic opportunity for Biden, of all people, to actually make some movement on this. And so yeah, Daniel, thanks so much for hopping on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
So you're co-authoring this op-ed with Zachary Elwood, who's another big kind of depolarization player. Can you talk about like what prompted you guys to write this piece?
Sure. So Zach has I'm a fan of Zach's writing. Zach's a former poker player, but he's gotten into the polarization game, as you say, and he's got a really neat book, and he's done a lot of podcast work and other writing, and I'm a fan of how he thinks. And we were in touch about how we're both scared and worried about what's gonna, I mean, a lot of people are concerned about the future of the US in a lot of ways. But in the short run, within the next year or so, with this big election looming, we're wondering what's going to happen. What can we do? So we exchanged some thoughts, and the main thought that we write about is this idea that at this point, just about everyone knows polarization is a big problem in America, including across the spectrum, and yet we're not, our government isn't doing any, our leaders aren't doing anything about it. So we have this grassroots, citizens movement to some extent, groups like Braver Angels and other groups. But when a country has a big problem, normally we look to our leaders to address the problem. And that's not really happening. And that strikes us as beyond disappointing. We would call it absurd, because it's just crazy when our biggest, we think it's the country's biggest problem, because it's the problem that prevents us from solving other problems, and it also is directly problematic in a lot of ways that it's being ignored by our leaders. So there's this question of what could our leaders do? And we propose that our commander-in-chief, our primary leader, President Biden, use his executive power to not to necessarily take particular actions, but to put together a group ASAP that directly addresses this and studies options for addressing polarization in the near term. So, and we share some ideas for specific things, specific possibilities that this group might look at. We suggest calling it the Depolarization Manhattan Project, because the idea is to mobilize some major resources to solve a major problem that our country, and the Manhattan Project was successful, of course. We put our heads together and the government said, okay, we've got to figure this thing out. We can do it if we try. Why? Let's do that for polarization. And we recognize that politicians typically don't do this, because the problem with one big problem with addressing polarization is you sort of acknowledge that the problem is it's a problem caused by people on both sides. It's not, you can't just blame the enemy. You can't just blame the opposition and say, we're doing everything great. All of our country's problems are due to the other party.
Yeah. Right?
And that's what politicians, of course, normally do. And that's, of course, what base, you know, relatively polarized voters do and what they look for. So we acknowledge that it would take some political courage for Biden to do this, but we urge him to do it because it's the right thing. And we think, who knows, maybe politically it'll pay off. Maybe there are enough sensible voters out there that would say, wow, this is an unusual politician who's actually taking some responsibility in addressing this hard problem. And so I should pause here, but like I said, we get into specific ideas that the Manhattan Project might address as well, which I could discuss if you like.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks so much for that summary. That was fantastic. And I do think that, because you brought up the question of political will, you know, will this come back to bite Biden or other leaders in the polls, or will it help? I actually think it could help. I read Peter Coleman's book, The Way Out, recently. He's a professor of psychology over at Columbia, who talks about a lot about affect polarization in his Difficult Conversations lab. And he pointed out that, you know, a study from Moore and Common came out a few years ago, and I found that 86% of Americans fall into what is called like the exhausted majority. So there's the 7%, 6 to 8% of far, far righters, and the 6 to 8% of far, far lefters, and they mostly yell at each other. And the other 86% of Americans think, man, can't we all just get along? You know, can't we all get back to compromise? Can our leaders get back to compromising? Can't we get back to doing something that moves the country forward instead of all this rancorous yelling at each other? And so it could be that there's this big opportunity for Biden and other leaders to tap into that 86%, that exhausted majority, that exhausted supermajority, and potentially win a groundswell, you know, win a groundswell election that way. What do you think?
Yeah. I don't know if it's 86% sounds a little optimistic in terms of the percentage of people who are not too polarized at this point.
Yeah.
It's probably accurate or low in reference to the percentage that's exhausted. But you're right. There could be a silent majority that would love it if a leader was willing to be critical of their own party and to acknowledge their contribution to how polarization is built up and to seriously grapple. So it's possible that political strategists underestimate the power and the size of this group because they're relatively quiet. Mm-hmm. It's also possible that they're quiet and therefore they don't donate as much and they're not as active in politics in a lot of ways. And so there could be some strategic wisdom to not paying as much attention to them. But I think you make a great point that the percentage of people who are not that polarized is still larger than most of us think. And it could be a sizable majority enough. You know, it's so hard to say with this stuff, but I agree that the size of that group might be underrated, and exactly because they tend to be, because they're less polarized, they tend to be quieter, and therefore we don't realize how many of them are out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like how you call the depolarization Manhattan Project, because obviously the Manhattan Project was created to fight against this existential threat that the U.S. faced. You know, if the U.S. started created nuclear bombs before the U.S. did, a lot of folks worried that we would be wiped off the face of the map. And similarly, in the op-ed, you talk about affect polarization as a kind of existential threat to the country. And I was wondering if you can talk a little more about that.
Sure. I mean, this is a subject of debate in academic literature, but I think there is a good amount of evidence, and it's to a large extent common sense, that, you know, affective polarization refers to, you know, emotional and polarization, increasing hostility and dislike toward our political opponents. And the more we dislike the other side, the more willing we are to do things that we wouldn't otherwise do, to say the ends justify the means. So it doesn't necessarily make us violent off the bat, but what there is evidence for is that it might make us support a politician who's from our party, who we normally wouldn't support, even though they're in our party. We might not like them because we think they're corrupt or dishonest, or they're willing to bend the rules in terms of electoral norms or policies, procedures. So, you know, in a healthy democracy where we don't hate the opposition, we might be willing to cross party lines and vote for the other party once in a while. We won't support our side by 100% of the time. Whereas the more we hate the opposition, the more willing we are to support people on our side we don't even respect, and the more we're willing to support fighting dirty, fighting harder. And we think fighting dirty is justified because we think they fight dirty. And the more we dislike them, the more we are prone to see them fight dirty even when they don't, right? Confirmation bias and all sorts of these issues like that are going to make us focus on the worst of their behaviors. And that's going to just make us reciprocate and escalate and also do things we wouldn't normally do. And these things build on each other, and it could lead to, you know, where there's on both sides, there are these huge questions of the strength of our democracy now. So that's there. You know, a lot of people think there is a real existential threat to this, the quality of American democracy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And in your article, you talk about Francis Fukuyama, the famous political scientist. He said that, you know, polarization is, quote, the single greatest weakness in the United States. Foreign Defense Secretary Robert Gates said that, you know, polarization is our, quote, greatest threats. And this is something I've written about here and there, because I really appreciate your point about fighting dirty, because it seems to me that the system of peaceful transfer of power that we have, and of separation of powers, this whole system of checks and balances, relies on seeing our political opponents as humans who are just trying to make their way in a muddled world and just trying to make the country better, even if we disagree with them. Whereas when we start seeing them as evil, as spiteful, as out to get us, as out to, you know, as sexist, as racist, as bigoted, there was an Axios poll where a lot of leftists saw rightists as sexist and bigoted, and a lot of rightists saw leftists as spiteful. And about 20% of both saw the other party as straight up evil, you know. When we start to see the other party as evil, or as out to get us, or as tremendously damaging to the country, then we can start to favor things like changing the electoral rules to keep our side in power. We can start to favor things like, hey, we have a majority in Congress, let's quickly pack the Supreme Court and expand it out to like 15, 20 justices. You know, Elizabeth Warren's talked about doing that, to basically make sure that Republicans can't get their way in the courts. Or you have obviously someone like Trump, who I love and admire many Trump supporters. I have family who are Trump supporters. They're wonderful, wonderful people. But Trump's whole thing was I will fight for you against the left, and I will beat the left into the ground and stomp their face into the mud. And the fact that that kind of like, I want a warrior, I want a bully to protect me, regardless, you know, whether you think he's a warrior or a bully, you know, that's kind of a sign, not maybe not a cause, but a sign of how dangerous this whole thing is. Because when we do all start to fight dirty, we end up with things like changing the rules. We end up with things like insurrections and the January 6th coup and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's so frustrating because I think we really should know better, you know, because so many of us have experienced this or observed this type of conflict between. So in my writing in my book on this in particular, I do think that the conflict between Republicans and Democrats is analogous to conflicts that occur between two people in a lot of contexts, when people grow apart, like friends or neighbors or spouses or whatever. And we know how easy it is for conflict to spiral out of control and become irrational. And for, you know, when you're mad at the other side, it's you just see them in the worst light and things naturally build. And anyone who's, you know, been around in this planet for a while, you know, sees that this is this aspect of human nature that it happens again and again. And yet when we're in the midst of it, when we're the ones who are getting really angry at the other side, we always forget, oh, maybe I am not seeing things clearly, and maybe I am just falling prone to this typical human tendency of getting into a conflict spiral. For whatever reason, evolution has programmed us to, you know, or whatever your theory is, you know, we have this tendency to, you know, once we get into a fight, we just want to keep fighting harder and be sure we win, and that can often mean thinking the worst of the other side and perceiving them in an overly negative way, because that motivates us or motivates our tribe to fight more effectively. You know, it happens in so many fictionals, you know, there, once you start looking out for this, you'll notice that like the plots of so many fictional works are driven by irrational misunderstanding. You know, one side just, people get angry with others, and it's almost always due to just a basic misunderstanding or misperception and thinking that they did something that which is worse than they really did, because usually, you know, the large majority of people just don't do things that are egregiously bad very often at all. And when we do things that appear egregiously bad, there's almost always a better explanation for that than what appears on the surface. And so when you see it happen in a book or a movie, it's like, oh yeah, of course they weren't as bad as it seemed, because if they were, it would have been unrealistically overly simplistic, because, you know, it would be like an old Disney movie, you know, for kids or something with a pure villain. But in reality, we don't have pure villains. When people do things that seem villainous, they've got their reasons and they've got their histories that make those actions seem actually more reasonable than they seem. And yet for some reason, we still do it, especially in politics, and we've got to figure this out. So I'm hoping, Zach and I are hoping we can get people to push, you know, Biden's in charge now and he's got the power of executive orders. We're hoping it's not too late for him to do it. And we talk about anything he's going to do at this point will be perceived as a political stunt. So one thing he might do as part of this is tell the project that one option they should consider is that he shouldn't run for president in 2024. They should evaluate that. They should consider options which don't serve him politically. And so he should be willing to make that sort of sacrifice. And the project, you know, ideally would use really transparent, clear scientific methods. I mean, one thought I had would be for them to do a very high quality research project where they essentially evaluated what would be the effect on polarization if Biden was to withdraw from the 2024 race. Would that help to convince, say, Republicans that the indictments of Trump were not motivated by Biden's desire to be reelected. And if the project used first-rate methods where the methods were pre-registered, so what you can do is commit to using certain survey questions and certain analytical techniques, and you did all that in advance, so no one could accuse you of, you know, screwing around with the data or just engineering the study to get the result you wanted. Maybe, who knows what the result would be, but it could be persuasive to people that he's trying to do what the country needs and not just what serves him politically. But you'd have to keep that in mind, that perception. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like that idea of, yeah, I actually, if push came to shove, I would vote for Biden over Trump. So I don't mean this as a partisan thing, but if he were willing to publicly say, let's consider all options on the table, including options that hurt me politically, including options that maybe I don't run again because, you know, I've become too polarizing, stuff like that. I think that would be very noble, you know, and it would sort of, it would take the wind out of the sails of a lot of folks who say that Biden is politically investigating Trump. Whether he is or not, it'd be a great way to show that, you know, that this is about something bigger than just one party. That's I really liked your point too about, you know, there's no such thing as like a pure like Disney villain. I'm reminded of the line from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, I think, which I'm probably butchering his name, but the author of the Gulag Archipelago. The line between good and evil runs not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart. And so we all have a little bit of both of that. You know, we all have a little bit of evil inside us, a little bit of good. And hopefully the good outweighs the evil. And I think it does for almost all humans, but we aren't all saints and our political opponents aren't all sinners.
Right. We have the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other. And so even, sure, there are times where each of us has done things that we regret, but that doesn't mean that we're permanently and completely that side of us, right? That So that's another reason why when people do things which seem really bad, one possibility is that those actions are not as bad as they seem. Another possibility is they were bad, but they don't represent us that well. We don't always do that. We were just gave in to the devil on our shoulder for the moment because it was a moment of weakness or who knows. But that's good to hear. That you think that Biden doing that might be persuasive to people who are not inclined to support Biden in terms of supporting his electoral, you know, the point here is to get support, figure out how to depolarize the country and convince people that we're all in this together and we need to figure out a solution that works. Nothing's going to be perfect for everyone, but let's work together here.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note of working together, you had some ideas for kind of structural changes to our political system that might help reduce affective polarization. Can you talk a little bit about those and how you think they might work?
Yeah. So there are a few that people talk about, and it's honestly, you know, I'm an economist, I'm a behavioral economist, which means I'm sort of a psychologist in disguise. Behavioral economics is, you know, it's incorporating psychology into economics, but to a large extent, it's economists studying psychological issues, but I'm not a political scientist for sure. And so those nuts and bolts are things of policy options. I'm not your best guy to talk to, but one particular option that appeals to me a lot is Supreme Court term limits, and not just term limits. I don't know if people are even talking about this, but I personally love the idea of just rotating Supreme Court appointments as long as we have a two-party system. And maybe that's a bad thing, but for now we have a two-party system. Let's not deny it. Instead of making the presidential election a referendum on Supreme Court justices, so if you get lucky, you know, so a lot of people hold their nose and vote for anyone just to get the Supreme Court justices that they want. to rotate justice appointments between the two parties. So Democrats get one, Republicans get the next one. Democrats get the next one, Republicans get the next one. And also,
oh, gotcha.
And tell the justices they can only serve for fixed terms. So people have said 18 years. And if it's 18-year terms, then there will be a new appointment, you know, every 2 years, whatever. I think.
Yeah.
2 times 9 is 18. Anyway. So I think that could be pretty effective in depolarizing, because it would reduce the motive of voters to support politicians they might perceive as bad actors or having character flaws just for the sake of these court appointments, which are super important. They're almost increasingly important, especially as Congress becomes more ineffective. We have this dominant executive branch and this powerful judicial branch. So that would, so it would make it, you know, there are obviously counter arguments and something, but that's one idea that appeals to me. Another idea is what's called final five voting for Congress. And I'm not even, the basic idea is to, currently, you know, primaries are sort of rigged. They have a skew towards selecting relatively extreme candidates because it's,
yeah,
voters with more extreme views who are more likely to vote in their party primaries, and so a lot of people think that that's a big part of the problem. And final five voting is a good, it's a very sensible proposal for overcoming that problem, and the problem of these safe districts nominating people for Congress who are not the ideal choice for the majority of the district, just because the primaries are not good representations of the district's preferences. And should we have more parties? Possibly. I mean, like, I think if we actually did this depolarization Manhattan Project, they should consider all kinds of crazy things, like freaking blowing up the whole party system we have, like literally like disbanding all Democrats and Republicans and start, you know, saying, I know this probably isn't feasible at all, but in this, for the sake of conversation, you know, Democrats and Republicans aren't working. So let's start over. There's no such thing as Democrats or Republicans anymore. We're going to create five new parties and see what happens. And then there is this idea of sort, this idea that politicians, there's a lot of research showing they're just psychologically, they have bad traits more than the average person. They act on both sides, you know, not necessarily one party or the other, but politics tends to select people who are.
Yeah. They're on average higher on ASPD, right? Am I getting that right?
Yeah. The dark triad of narcissism and Machiavellianism and cynicism. And so there's some talk of pushing for more citizen representation and not necessarily choosing a random person to be president, but choosing people to be on committees in the same way that we pick them to be on juries to do our
job.
So sortition. Anyway, so there's all kinds of ideas. I think rotating court appointments seems pretty easy. Let the Manhattan Project figure it out. That's what we say.
Absolutely. When I was at the Brave Angels convention, are you going to be there this next year? And the reason I ask is because I actually first heard about sortition from two independent groups who were there. One was my friend Monica Guzman, who we were talking about something related, and one was a group, and I actually forget the name of it, but they were pretty serious about it. They had some good evidence that it worked pretty well in some other countries where they tried it on kind of a small scale. So I was wondering if you were coming there, because you may find some more folks who are really, really serious about these kind of out of the box structural changes.
Good to hear. Maybe I should go.
Of course, yeah. If you sign up through like Brave Angels emails, I think they'll
probably
advertise it at some point.
I got the emails and I keep an eye on things, but it's good to know. Yeah.
Cool. As we're starting to wrap up here, is there anything else you would like our listeners to know? Anything about effective polarization or about your work or about, you know, kind of moonshot opportunities you think are out there, or more ground opportunities, or anything in particular that you think you really want our listeners to know about?
That's a good, we've covered some, of the things that I was most excited to talk to you about. I guess beyond polarization in the US, now we have one of the most polarizing issues of all time across the whole world, flaring up now with the conflict in Gaza, Israel and Gaza and Hamas and Palestine. So to me, this is another case study in how good and reasonable people can come to very, very different opinions on a complicated topic, and therefore grow to be very angry and very sure of themselves because they have a lot of data and arguments in support of their opinion. And yet, things are complicated, and there's a reason that there's a bunch of people out there who disagree with you, and it's not that they're all idiots or they're all evil. And
Very true.
Israel, just what's going on there, I think is a case in point of how this happens again and again. But we so if hopefully it can we can see from that how easy it is to get into this mindset and to make the mistake of thinking that things are simple and clear when they're not, because it's the ultimate complex issue in some ways. Whatever, I think, there are a lot of reasons that these conflicts tend to escalate. One big reason is selective memory, right? And people thinking about the history as justifying what their side is doing now or in the future, but thinking about one view of the history and how they're remembering the good things that their side did and the bad things the other side did, and just forget it. And it seems so obvious and cliche, and yet it just, you see it all the time in these conversations where, one side will say, well, we'll go back to this point and just forget about, I can't believe, so and so happened in this point in time, and then forget about what happened the day before that that caused it, and what happened the day before that. And so for what it's worth, use the complexity of that conflict to help us to remember that it's not just the tricky thing is sometimes there is a clear right and wrong, right? Sometimes there is a good guy and a bad guy, and that's why you can't simply say anytime two people are fighting, it's always complicated and they're both equally right and wrong, right? So that's why it is so hard to sort these things out, because sometimes you do have to go to battle and really fight hard for the right side. But we have a tendency to do that too much and to underestimate how the complexity of these conflicts and the legitimacy of the views of those who we disagree with.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. And yeah, I think you're exactly right about complexity because yeah, there are cases. It's rarely the case that both sides are exactly equal in the harm they've done or things like that or how right they are. But it's also very rarely the case, even rarer, I think, that one side is all good and one side is all bad. You might look at Nazi Germany, you might look at like Stalin's USSR, but in the US, that kind of binariness is very rare. So maybe we should all spend a little more time thinking about the complexity of the world and thinking about the complexity of the issues and let that complexity kind of shape our perspectives rather than letting our perspectives shape how much of that complexity we see. Thanks so much for dropping on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And for anyone listening, my book is open access online. You can grab the PDF for free. That's Undue Hate, and hopefully I can post a link or something. But
Yeah, definitely.
and there's hard copies out there too if you want to spend a few bucks, but not worried about that. But thanks for having me. It was really nice to talk to you. I really appreciate it. Good questions, and appreciate your response to all my questions. I made a lot of great points.
Of course.
Keep it
Oh,
alive.
and wh where else can folks find you? I know they can find your book, but are you on social media? Do you have a website?
I restrain. I'm still on Twitter. I'm at D underscore F underscore Stone, and I'm on Blue Sky. and DF Stone. I think no underscores there. I'm not even sure. And
Cool.
you can, you know, I teach at Bowdoin College, which is hard to spell, but Bowdoin College. If you want to check out my college website.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Julian.
All right.
Friends, if there's anything in this episode that provided exceptional value to you, please make sure to hit that share button. Share it with your friends, share it far and wide. And of course, if you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe right from our website so you can get the Derate the Hate podcast sent to your email inbox every week. So this is Wilk wrapping up for the week saying get out there, be kind to one another, be grateful for everything that you've got, and remember it's up to you to make each and every day the day that you want it to be. If there is something that you would like to share with me, you can catch me on most social media platforms, or you can email me directly, wilk@wilksworld.com. With that, my friends, I am going to back on out of here, and we will catch you next week. Take care.